Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Representative Chris Stewart slams Robert Mueller's Russia probe. The Utah Supreme Court finds that a state panel was unconstitutionally blocking medical malpractice lawsuits, and the hectic work schedule of a Utah public defender. Joining me for this conversation is Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller. And good morning to you, Jessica.
Good morning.
We've also got news columnist Robert Gerke. Hi, Robert. Thanks for being here.
Hi, good morning.
And on the phone from the nation's capital, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Thanks for joining us again, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. And the number to call to join this conversation is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet questions and comments to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Thomas Burr, the oracle of the Russia investigation, special counsel Robert Mueller testified before Congress this week. And there's been a lot of analysis over how he said what and what it all means and what's new, a partisan divide over the facts and over what was important from that testimony. Utah Representative Chris Stewart got in on the action, and Tommy, Representative Stewart lashing out a little at Robert Mueller over this investigation. This was during Mueller's testimony, right?
He did, and Stewart was the only Utahn on one of the committees that actually heard from Robert Mueller. And Stewart has been a pretty staunch defender of the president during all of the Russia investigation. Some points the congressman didn't even accept the intelligence committee's assertion that the Russians were trying to help Trump and hurt Clinton. He admits that they tried to interfere in the election, but that it wasn't to help Trump. And so Stewart took the opportunity when he got to his questions to slam Mueller and say, you've ensnared, innocent people in this. They've had their lives destroyed, and they had to sit there and wait for 22 months until the report came out so they could say, see, I didn't do anything wrong. Specifically, he's talking about, the president and, his family, his son, Donald Trump Jr., who, by the way, were not necessarily all exonerated by the report. In fact, Mueller made it very clear in his testimony that they didn't even look at whether they should charge the president because the Justice Department policy is that you don't charge a sitting president. So the report did not necessarily say that. But Stewart took the opportunity to say, your team was leaking to the media and making these people look bad, and you pretty much owe them an apology.
There was also this moment where Stewart held up a binder that he said contained leaks. This has to do with the media. Maybe you can tell us about this part of the story of Representative Stewart's testimony during this hearing, Tommy.
Sure, and I would like to see the binder because I'm trying to figure out he didn't offer any proof of how he knew that the leaks came from the special counsel's office, and in fact, just dealing with the special counsel's office myself, they were incredibly tight-lipped. I mean, there was a New York Times story that they wouldn't even confirm what lunch they had ordered that day. They were not really known to be leaking at all. In fact, from what we know, is leaks are largely coming from Trump's own team to kind of inoculate himself in some ways. Like they'd leak some little bit out so it didn't look so damning when it all came down in the report. But Stewart claimed he had 25 examples of when this special counsel's office was leaking to make the president look bad, again, without ever giving us that proof, just a white binder he had apparently filled with this magical formula showing they'd leaked.
You mentioned the fact that it's not as though, I mean, this report, the Mueller report, didn't, while it didn't, indict the president and people very close to him, it did indict a number of others, and actually some of them who were very close to him. I guess maybe, I'm going to turn over to Robert Gerke, who's a news columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune, and ask, if you look at this from like the partisan political perspective, Robert, this is either evidence of a willingness to accept help from a foreign adversary, Russia, to get elected, and then also later obstruction of justice, or it's this unfair impugning of the president and his associates, as Representative Chris Stewart is saying. And the political optics have overtaken everything, and that makes it kind of hard to take anyone's statements, or at least anyone in the political sphere's statements, at face value.
Well, I'm going to suggest that it isn't an either or. It's not all black and white. You don't have to be a partisan hack like Chris Stewart is to view this thing as we needed to investigate this. If Russia is infiltrating our elections, that needs to be investigated. And if the president is obstructing justice, that needs to be investigated. And during the course of that, there are going to be people in the president's orbit who are going to be under scrutiny. There's nothing wrong with that. That's part of the process. And if they're not charged, great. Then they can go about their lives. And it's unfortunate for them, I guess, that they have to, sweat a little because they did things that were questionable. But they did things that were questionable, and those things needed to be looked at. And Chris Stewart needs to be part of the process of improving government and strengthening our government, not part of the process of defending a president who may have broken the law. And so for him to come out and say, well, you've sullied these people's reputation. No, these people sullied their own reputation by their own actions and deeds. And that's why we had a special counsel appointed. And by the way, the special counsel was appointed by the Republican-led Justice Department. It's part of the process, and he needs to accept that, and he needs to stop being such a partisan shill and defending everything the president does. And as far as these leaks go, one of the questions that the special counsel got during these hearings was, did you leak this letter to the Justice Department expressing your displeasure at the way that the report was rolled out? And clearly that he didn't leak that, because the copy of the letter that the press obtained said it had been received by the Office of the Attorney General. So either Mueller gave it to the Office of Attorney General and then got the copy back and then leaked it, or else the leak came from the Justice Department. The Republican Justice Department leaked it. So, all of this stuff is a bunch of showboating. Now, that said, the hearing itself was a lot of showboating. There wasn't new information really gleaned from it. It was mostly so Democrats could try to question Mueller and pin him down on things which they couldn't do. And there was some value in it, because I think a lot of the public has not actually read the report.
Right.
And so maybe they have a better understanding. But it didn't change anybody's minds. We're in such a divided partisan country that people can't look at this through rational and untainted eyes, I think. And so it was largely a waste of time. And Chris Stewart's a waste of time.
Robert Kirky is a columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'll just point that out again. Thomas Burr, the special counsel, I should say former special counsel at this point, I think, Robert Mueller, he also in his testimony tried to keep drawing attention to something that happened in 2016 and that he says is happening even now, Russian interference in our elections. Is that... Robert Kirky's talking about the partisan sort of goggles people are wearing. Is that getting lost in that political battle? The urgent sort of call from the special counsel about Russian interference.
Absolutely, and that's the main problem. I think Mueller was really stressing this during his hearing. He's like, okay, stop your bickering, guys. We have a real problem. And Russia, he's like, right now is actually trying to interfere in our elections, and they're going to interfere in our elections. And you're all focused on this one thing, which is important, but we should also be doing something about that. And it shouldn't be a partisan thing by any means. The Republicans have as much interest in ensuring that our elections are secure and not meddled in by foreign countries with their own agendas. That said, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell does not plan to bring up legislation that Democrats say could help, protect the sanctity of the elections in 2020 and going forward. Obviously, the House has passed legislation to try to do so, but the Senate doesn't do anything, and nothing will happen. And that just seems it seems like there's absolute broad sweeping support for this, that the Republicans are using, Mueller's Russia investigation as cover instead of passing legislation that actually affects going forward.
I mean, the Russia probe was about, Russia, going in and trying to choose a candidate and throw support behind them in a kind of covert way. And Robert Kirky, in particular, social media influencing, social media manipulation, that was a big part of the interference in 2016. And I'm imagining as the special counsel said, is happening right now and is going to happen in 2020. What do you say to that?
I mean, keep in mind, that's where this whole thing started, is with an investigation into infiltration of our election by a foreign power, a foreign adversary, you could say. And so yes, everything that sort of unfolded from there is appropriate. Another thing that didn't get nearly as much attention is that the Senate Intelligence Committee finally released volume one of its report on the Russian hacking. And it was, I mean, maybe not revelatory, you know, but it was significant, you know. And so, look, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I think everybody should want to know that our elections are conducted above board, and that, you know, that, I mean, the Senate committee actually said that Russia had hacked two states' election systems, or one state, and tried to, and all 50 states had been targeted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is not made up. This is not, you know, this is not partisan. This is not some spin, you know. And so maybe that's where we should focus. And so the legislation is apparently not going anywhere. I guess maybe Senator McConnell thinks that it worked out for his team and so he doesn't need to do anything about it. But, you know, we need to be vigilant about this, and we should be investigating it.
Thomas Spurr in Washington, are we going to hear anything more from Mueller, or was this sort of the capstone to this story? I mean, this is, you know, his final public appearance, his last concert.
I think he jumped on his horse and rode into the sunset after this hearing. I don't think he's ever coming back. I'm sure maybe some legal stuff later on, but they're not going to bring him back. This was kind of a dud of a hearing. Everyone kind of acknowledges, so he's gone. Hopefully, he's playing some golf somewhere.
You know, actually, before we turn to another story, did any other state lawmakers, do we get a response from any other federal lawmakers from Utah that is on this testimony, Tommy?
Yeah, actually, Representative Rob Bishop put out a statement, and I can't say I disagreed with him. He said the book was better than the movie. And if you really look at it, I'm one of the few people in America who's actually read the Mueller report, you know, it's full of just fascinating details that the hearing didn't really get into.
Okay.
Before we move on, I mean, Tommy, correct me if I'm wrong, but Chris Stewart can talk about how this is smoke and mirrors, all this investigation, but the fact of the matter is there have been 34 guilty pleas and just a slew of charges.
34 indictments.
Indictments, thank you. Yeah, I think 7 guilty pleas and 34 indictments. And so, let's not pretend that this was much ado about nothing. So we got to keep that in perspective.
Okay. Again, Robert Gerke is a columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments. Before we head to a break, I want to squeeze in an update to something that we discussed last Friday. Thomas Burr, Senator Mike Lee, had come under fire at that point for blocking a vote on legislation to extend the compensation fund for victims of the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks. And then we learned that a deal had been struck, so Lee could offer an amendment, which you told us about last week. In the end, though, Senator Lee was one of two senators voting against extending funding for this 9/11 Victims Fund. What happened since last Friday, Tommy?
Yeah, so Senator Lee got his amendment before the on the floor, as did Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. Both were trying to limit what the fund would do. So just the backup, the whole legislation essentially extends this program through 2092. Essentially, anyone who had worked there as a first responder, firefighter, paramedic, you know, a police officer, would be past their life expectancy at end. So it essentially said, here's all the money you need. There's no limit through 2092 to take care of these people. And Lee said that was a bad idea, that we should have, we could fund it for 10 years, $10 billion, and then they, come back and Congress can authorize the program again. So he got his amendment on the floor. It was rejected soundly. I think we were like 33 votes for it. And then Rand Paul's amendment went down. And so when it came down to the overall bill, which, again, just funds it through 2092, there's no dollar limit. It's just here's, the money for the cancer you got or the asthma you have or whatever disease you're facing because of, your work at Ground Zero. And Lee and Rand Paul voted against it, that they felt like this is, that they shouldn't just write a blank check going for 73 more years.
Right. Essentially, the amendment would have shortened the time span. Would it have been less money? I mean, or would it have been less money for a shorter period of time? So would it have been an equivalent amount of money over that shorter period of time?
Essentially, it was $10 billion, a little over $10 billion for 10 years. And then after that 10 years, there was $10 more billion in Mike Lee's amendment. So $20 billion for the life of the program. Mm. And we don't know what the costs are going to be. They've put out, I think they've appropriated around $7.4 billion already. But now, this is about the time when who worked at 9/11 on the ground trying to rescue people or put the fire out. This is the time when they're starting to get really sick, that they may have got cancer a few years ago, but this is when the next 10 years you're going to see, a lot of people who need care. In the end all, Mike Lee didn't really issue a statement after he walked off the floor after his amendment failed, came back and, voted against the bill, and they didn't want to comment.
How did Utah's other Senator Mitt Romney vote on this?
Mitt Romney voted for Mike Lee's amendment. He voted for Rand Paul's amendment, which would have offset the costs, essentially. It was said, okay, well, we can fund this. We have to cut, other programs to fund it. But then Mitt Romney voted for the overall bill. He said, we should have some fiscal restraints, but we've got to take care of these guys.
Okay. Robert Gerke, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, I believe you wrote a column that touched on this week. What was the gist of that?
Well, I mean, the gist of it was that Mike Lee is doing a disservice to the men and women who sacrificed to try to rescue people. It turns out not rescue people, try to recover bodies that worked on this heap of rubble after 9/11. I mean, they showed a great deal of courage and they were told it was safe and it wasn't. And they were ingesting toxins. They were breathing in ground glass and asbestos and soot and more than 60 of Mike Lee's own constituents, Utah firefighters who were part of Task Force One, went to the 9/11 site, and tried to do what they could do, tried to help. There were dog handlers from Utah, civilians who were out there, doing what they could do. Everybody was trying to do what they could do, and they were told it was safe. It wasn't. They got sick. We need to take care of them. Now, Mike Lee's point is, well, Congress needs oversight. Well, this is a congressional program. Congress always has, always will have oversight over it. There's never been an instance of fraud in the life of this program, and it's got thorough checks by the Department of Justice, by the Inspector General. It's basically a sham, and he's being disingenuous or a liar if he thinks that he's doing anybody any favors, and he's going to wrap himself in the flag, and he tried to wrap himself in the flag after he blocked this from coming to a vote. He put out a press release that says Mike Lee secures vote on this bill. No, you didn't. The bill was coming up for a vote. You just didn't block it anymore because you're going to get a vote on your stupid amendment that's going to get defeated anyway, so you can look like you're some sort of conservative champion. You're not. You're a showboat. And stop it.
I mean, is that the
Robert? Tell us what you really think.
Yeah, tell us.
I'm fired up, and I'm trying to make sure that Roger doesn't have to bleep me on this because I'm pretty fired up about this.
You could tell that Robert Gerke is fired up. But I mean, the point is that also to a certain extent, his no vote on this was obviously a protest. It was going to pass anyway.
I mean,
making a statement, the amendment to a certain extent was also making a statement. You're saying that those statements were unnecessary and
look, I guess it's necessary if you think we're actually not going to take care of these people. But the fact of the matter is, we're going to take care of these people. If we did it Mike Lee's way and we'd appropriated the $10 billion and we ran out of the $10 billion and there were still 100 people that need to be paid, Congress is going to take care of those people. So just take care of those people and don't leave this hanging over them. Right now, the special master who administers this fund is having to reduce the payments to individuals who qualify for compensation because the fund is depleting. So just take care of them. Don't keep doing this dog and pony show, and just because you're a fiscal conservative. Stop it. Just do the right thing for once in your life.
That, again, is Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Thomas Burr, is that, I mean, you said this is funded for another 72 years, is that right?
Yeah, essentially, through 2092. And there's no dollar number, there's no dollar amount in the legislation. So essentially, they're going to get what money they need to take care of these guys.
We've done this sort of thing before. When Utah had downwinders, you remember that, people who were sickened by fallout, radioactive fallout from nuclear tests, they were entitled. It became an entitlement that if you qualify for the program, the money will be paid to you. It's not a matter of a constant appropriation in this dog and pony show where you have to come back every time. So, you know, that way, if the government shuts down, because guess what? The government shuts down, you're going to get your money. Mm-hmm. And just to reiterate the point, I mean, some of these people were 20 years old when they went out there, and they now are in their 30s and have cancer. That's a serious thing. That's not something that happens by chance. And so it's clearly linked to the work they did, to the courage they showed and the selfless sacrifice they showed. So just do the right thing and take care of these people.
All right. You are listening again to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We need to head to a break, but first we're going to say goodbye to Thomas Burr, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Salt Lake Tribune. And Tommy, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to look at some stories from the Utah Supreme Court saying that rules on medical malpractice lawsuits are unconstitutional. Again, this is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller and columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to at KCPW. Jessica Miller, thanks again for being here. Mm-hmm. You covered a decision by the Utah Supreme Court this week having to do with medical malpractice suits in Utah. And how malpractice suits happen in the state, or how they are authorized to happen, is more complicated than I realized. So
yeah.
Maybe you can first off tell us about the kind of convoluted process for a patient trying to sue a doctor for malpractice here in Utah, what that process looks like, you know, or what they've had to go through to do that. And then maybe we'll turn to the news that is from this week.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people think, you know, something bad happens to you in a hospital that you just go get a lawyer and you file a lawsuit. And it's much more complicated than that. You have to go through this process called a pre-litigation hearing, where you go to a panel, which is set up by the state licensing agency. The panel consists of a doctor or medical professional, a lawyer, and then a layperson. And you basically present your case. This is why I think I've been wronged and I want to sue. And that panel makes a finding saying your claims have merit or they don't. Most of the time, the panel says your claims don't have merit. And for years, you could still go file your lawsuit anyways. It basically was just like a hoop that you had to jump through before you took your case to court. But in 2010, lawmakers passed a bill that added another layer to the process, where if you did not get a, if your claim didn't have merit, if the panel decided your claim didn't have merit, you had to go find a medical professional who could say, sign an affidavit that says that the claims did have merit. But this same panel gave the final approval of whether that affidavit was good enough. So essentially, they had the power to block lawsuits from ever making it to the courtroom. Or if they did, people filed anyways, the cases would just get dismissed because it's in the law that you need to have this certificate from this panel.
What is the sort of stated purpose of that panel's existence? I mean, how did that come to be, and why is that hurdle there for people to jump through?
I think the idea behind it is to kind of weed out those frivolous lawsuits. You know, sometimes people might go to that pre-litigation hearing and decide their case maybe isn't as strong as they thought it was. So that was kind of the idea, is, you know, there's this concern about the rising cost of healthcare. How do we combat that? Legislators decided to put this pre-litigation hearing in place.
So this panel, again, as you said, in essence, could prevent a medical lawsuit from ever reaching the courtroom. Then we get this week the decision from the Utah Supreme Court, and it came in a very specific case where this panel had stopped a malpractice suit from advancing, from moving forward. Can you tell us about that case?
Yeah, so the case was about a man who had gone in for a pretty routine surgery, and he woke up in a coma and then died a week later. And it was kind of this like mystery of how they couldn't quite pinpoint what happened to him, and the medical records weren't exactly very clear, that the doctors didn't keep a good record of what had happened. So the panel had said that the claims didn't have merit. The medical professional that they had hired to sign an affidavit basically said, you know, he couldn't give a reason why, but the death seemed highly suspect, and the panel decided that that wasn't a good enough reason, and so they wouldn't give a certificate unless this person had amended the affidavit, the medical professional. Mm. The woman who's the wife of the man who had died, she filed her lawsuit anyways, and the judge was forced to dismiss it because it clearly states in the law, if you don't have the certificate from this panel, your lawsuit can't go forward. So after that lawsuit was dismissed, then they appealed to the Utah Supreme Court, and they found that the process of the pre-litigation hearing is okay. It's that added process of requiring this medical professional to have the signed affidavit, and that has to go through the panel as well, giving them essentially the power that should be reserved for judges. It gave them that power when they shouldn't have that.
So the panel then, I mean, as a result of the decision, how will processes go forward? It'll revert to it being, there will be a panel, but there won't be the doctor who you can go to and appeal. Explain what.
Yeah,
how
exactly.
It will
stay. That's exactly what will happen. It's the pre-litigation hearing process will remain the same. It'll just basically be like it was pre-2010. Before it was like you jumped through the hoop. You probably got your not credible finding, because it sounds like that's mostly what was happening in these cases. One attorney I talked to estimated it was probably only like 15 or 20% of cases. They say that there was merit to the case. So that process will still stay in effect.
I'm curious. If you go to the panel says this doesn't have merit, but now despite the fact that the panel says that, you can still take your lawsuit forward.
Right. Okay. And that's how it was pre-2010 also. It just basically, you know, you just take your not merit finding and you go file in court anyways. You know, obviously that can have an effect on like negotiations and settlements, things like that. But it doesn't prevent the lawsuit from being filed. And that's where the problem was that, you know, you can't give this panel the absolute power to say whether a lawsuit should go to court or not. That's left for judges. That's for the judicial branch to decide.
Okay. I'm going to remind listeners that to join this conversation, you can call 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And actually, we have somebody on the line who wants to comment on a previous story. But first, I want to close this one out, Jessica, before we head back that direction. And one of the attorneys who represents this woman whose case was used in this Supreme Court decision, he said that he wished the court would have ruled the entire pre-litigation process unconstitutional, mm-hmm. including those panel hearings, because he sees these panels as inherently biased. And your description of the vast majority being found without merit mm-hmm. kind of lends credence to that idea. Can you describe his argument?
Yeah. So he, you know, was making the argument that a doctor is inherently biased in this process. Like if you're having a panel hearing focusing on what a radiologist did, the idea that you have another Utah radiologist on this panel and that they're going to find that their colleague did something wrong is not going to happen. And that doctor has a lot of power on that panel, because if you're the doctor and the person next to you is just a regular citizen and the other person's a lawyer and you tell them, well, you know, in my medical opinion, this doesn't have merit, you're going to tend to side with the doctor because they have that specialized experience. So his argument is, these people who are on this panel who are making these decisions would not even qualify to be on a jury at a trial because they're biased. They have this inherent bias in what the work that they're doing. And so he views that entire panel process as being a biased process and shouldn't be happening.
Well, let's go to Robert Gerke, news columnist. You know, what about this panel and the role that it played in keeping some claims from, you know, even making it into the legal system? This was, of course, before this Supreme Court decision. Now they can get into the legal system, but on these panels in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we all sort of have a fundamental constitutional right to go to court and to make our case before a judge and to to try to prove that we've been wronged in some way, whether that's malpractice or any other lawsuit that might be filed. And so to set up barriers to that, I think the Supreme Court was right that that's improper to take away somebody's right to present their case for their day in court. And so I think that's an improvement. I think there's a valid point to the argument that this panel does have an inherent conflict and that these are doctors. I mean, you want experts in the field to review these claims. I'd also be curious to try to figure out, and it would take some time, but try to figure out if this is actually paid dividends. Have we seen a reduction versus other states in the number of malpractice cases that have been filed? Are we actually saving money on our insurance premiums or doctors' malpractice insurance by having this in place? Or are we just erecting barriers to people seeking justice? That's a question for another day, I suppose.
Well, I was going to say that I think that you could definitely draw a line between, you know, when this panel could prevent cases from getting to court, to trial, then yeah, you would definitely have seen a reduction, whether or not again.
You would think, but has it actually played out that way? But right. Yes, and yeah, but going back to the, you know, going back to the larger point, that yes, these people who feel they have been wronged, whether they've been wronged or not, should be able to go to court and present their case. And if the judge at court says your case doesn't have merit, then it gets thrown out, right? And doctors don't have to worry about that. I mean, I realize that there's cost to litigation and the process is expensive and so forth. But you know, if they're convinced that these are frivolous claims, then they'll be handled appropriately.
That'll come out in court.
That's what the court system is there for, right? I mean, that's the whole point of it. Is so you can present your case, I'll present my case, whichever one has most compelling evidence is going to prevail. And so, you know, that's how the process is supposed to work. Let's not monkey with that and put in obstacles along the way.
Jessica Miller, mm-hmm. You sought a response from a state lawmaker who is also a physician. This is Representative Ray Ward, a Republican lawmaker from Bountiful. What was his response to this decision by the Utah Supreme Court?
I mean, I think that he thought that the pre-litigation hearing process, you know, it has a place. He wanted to keep that going forward. I guess we'll see this next legislative session if lawmakers react to this by, changing the law again, maybe looking at the pre-litigation hearings in general. I guess we'll just have to see how that goes next year.
And then also the sponsor of the original bill in 2010 that made it that you had to get that doctor's sort of opinion before you could go. This is Stuart Adams, who is now the Senate president. What does he say about this decision?
He agreed with it. He said that, you know, they put this into place and sometimes you need more clarity on the situation. And so he thought that it was a good decision.
Okay. A reminder to listeners that this is Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. And just because we have some time before we head to a break, I'm going to bring in a caller. This is Eloise from Salt Lake City, who has a comment about a story we were touching on earlier, which is the Mueller hearings and the response from Representative Chris Stewart. Anyway, Eloise from Salt Lake City, what comment do you have about that story?
Oh, I want to say this is a really great program.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, you're all really good. Sorry. And I'm very concerned about our democracy. And, you know, Chris Stewart, the way he peppered Director Mueller, who has nothing but the highest integrity, and accused him of things that are not true, it's really shameful to put him through that. And I thank you, Gerke, for saying your comments about him and about Mike Lee and the compensation fund. These things are no-brainers. And you're exactly right. He's just putting up his front to get his name on the papers. So I hope this country can get back together. And so I just encourage everyone, get out there, get registered, please, and vote next year, and let's get some people in office who really want to do something for the people of this country.
Thank you very much, Eloise, for your comments. A call for civic participation from Eloise there, and also some agreements with things that Robert Kirky has been saying about the Mueller trial and the Mike Lee story that we covered before. Okay, so now we have to head to a break in the show. And listeners, this is Behind the Headlines. When we come back, we've got more, including a profile on a Utah public defender and their casework. Check it out here on the show after this break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke and Jessica Miller. It is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them to sltrib.com, or you can tweet to us. We are at KCPW. Robert Gerke, I want to squeeze in a story before I turn to this profile of a Utah public defender from Jessica Miller about Utah's relatively young new political party. This is the United Utah Party. They emerged in 2017 as an alternative to the major parties. And this week they announced that they are working on a ballot initiative to institute term limits for state lawmakers, a 3-term limit on state senators, 6-term limit on state representatives, and an 8-year cap on the statewide positions of governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, treasurer, and auditor. And again, this would be through a ballot initiative. The party's chairman, Richard Davis, said that the goal is to restore the idea or the ideal of citizen service and discourage career politicians. Anyway, that's the background there. Is this a good idea? Is it a bad idea? I know you wrote a column about it. That's why I'm prepping you.
Yeah, I mean, let's start with sort of the objective analysis. I mean, this is an issue that has gone before voters before. I mean, last time we really had a debate about it was in the early 90s. Merrill Cook was proposing it. It's a popular populist move. Back in 93, when this was originally proposed, the legislature enacted term limits. It sort of cut the legs out from under the initiative drive that they were pushing that at the time. And then the legislature came back and repealed it before they actually took effect. And that was, as I said in my column, it was a pretty cynical move. But so the United Utah Party is trying to do this. Their contention is that it would get rid of the sort of lifetime legislators. That it would increase turnover, make legislators be more responsive to the public. It would, you know, avoid stagnation, I guess, and you know, empower voters to decide their representatives. Now that's sort of more the objective. The challenge they have, obviously, is that they have to get these 100+ thousand signatures to get it on the ballot. And that's going to take a lot of time and money and organization, and it's a hard task. But you know, we saw with the last election, 3 propositions made it on the ballot, so it's an achievable task.
Right, but then there's the next part of that, which is maintaining what you passed, and not having it changed by the state legislature.
Yeah, obviously any of these, you know, there are several proposed or ideas floated for initiatives. Clean the Darn Air is one that's out there right now. All of these have to deal with that obstacle of the legislature coming back and monkeying with it, and you can't control that ultimately. My opinion on this is that, you know, it feels right, right? We none of us want our lawmakers to be, you know, these sort of lifetime politicians.
Unto themselves.
Yeah. But I think when you start looking at it a little more carefully, I have some real problems with this, because states that have had term limit initiatives have not actually had more turnover in their legislature than states that don't. We in Utah actually do have pretty frequent turnover. The average tenure for a senator, the average amount of experience for a senator, according to the data that Adam Brown from BYU has put together, is 9.5 years roughly for a senator, 5 years for a representative. So we do see pretty good churn. As I mentioned, Arizona enacted term limits. They actually had legislators serving longer than they were before, because they would stay through
the full term.
Those that do get term limited out would often run for the upper chamber. So then instead of 12 years, you've got 24 years of eligibility. Or they would go away and they would come back after what they call the cooling off period, which is 2 years for a representative, 4 years for a senator. Just kind of, you know, they can come back if they want to do that. The other thing that, you know, in Michigan, when they enacted term limits, they had a spike in lawmakers becoming lobbyists. So anyway, there's a lot of it's fraught with problems, and also just fundamentally, I think voters should be able to choose the representative they want. If Roger, you're a representative, and everybody loves you, you know, and you're doing a great job, they should be able to put you back in office if they want to, and it shouldn't be up to the rest of the state to tell you that no, you've served 12 years, you have to leave. And so that's my. Those are some of my problems with the term limit.
And some of the points that you made in your column, which listeners can check out at sltrib.com. In the interest of time, though, I want to turn to a story that Jessica Miller wrote, and this will be our final story before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. This is a profile of one Utah public defender in St. George, and this is one busy attorney, Jessica Miller, and busier now than in years past. Can you first of all maybe actually remind us what the public defender system is all about here in the United States? It's something that we have a right to, all of us.
Yes, it's in the Constitution. If you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. And so how the government funds this program depends state by state. Here in Utah, they've delegated that responsibility to counties and cities. So that basically means you kind of have this patchwork system where, you know, if you're in Salt Lake County, there's a nonprofit public defender office. They've got social workers and, you know, more funding, things like that. Down in St. George, where Ed Flint, the attorney that I profiled, where he's at, they just do flat fee contracts with individual attorneys. So no matter how many cases Ed has, whether it's 50 or 250, he's getting paid the exact same amount.
And how many cases does he have right now?
Currently, he has 287 cases, which is a lot.
And just for perspective, and because I think it's interesting, how much is that flat fee that this attorney, this one public defender, gets paid?
So Ed is paid $58,000 a year, and that is he doesn't have health insurance, he doesn't have a retirement plan. You know, costs such as like his renting his office space, paying for paper, staples, folders, things like that. All of that comes out of that amount that he's paid.
Part of the reason that you were down there in St. George this week had to do with some news that broke, which is that there will be a little bit of a bump in pay for public defenders down there. How much money are we talking about?
So a couple of years ago in 2016, the state started this Indigent Defense Commission. And what they do is they give out state grants to counties to help them pay for public defenders. Because, you know, looking at the system, it's been problematic. And so Washington County was just given a grant. It was for like $194,000, I think. And with that money, they'll be able to hire one more public defender. And then all of the public defenders that are already on contract will get a $500 a month raise. But there's still concern. You know, this attorney that I talked to,
right,
he says that's not nearly enough. I mean, he thinks they need at least former public defenders. He would like it to transition to a nonprofit public defender office like we have here in Salt Lake County or in Utah County, that's the better model to be looking at than these flat fee contracts.
Can you describe again, remind us of the difference between the nonprofit public defender model mm-hmm. and the way that it happens in St. George? I mean, why would a nonprofit model have a greater degree of funding?
So with that model, you have, you know, social workers who are working in the office so they can help your clients. You've got access to more money to hire like defense experts. You've got like a secretary who would like help you answer your calls and like answer emails. And of course, you've got more support. I mean, it's more you've got health benefits. You probably have like supervisors. You know, it's run like an office. Right. Where what he is doing is he's just out on his own with this flat fee contract. He's doing all of his own secretary work. He's you know, he probably can't hire defense experts. He's kind of acting as the social worker. You know, telling his clients, you know, go to this drug rehab program, or, you know, continue doing this, whatever, the things that there's support staff for in these nonprofit offices.
And his caseload can span any number of things, right? He's not specializing in one particular type of law. He's a
right.
public defender, so he's defending the public in whatever the case may be.
Yeah, so it's district court, so there are some, you know, there are misdemeanor cases. He's got DUIs, he's got drug charges, things like that. But then it runs the gamut. I mean, he's had homicide cases. He's had child sex abuse cases. He was representing a young man down there who had been accused of bringing a bomb to a high school. I mean, it really runs from like a DUI to an attempted bombing. It's everything in between.
And 287 cases, you said, that's a lot. Washington County at one point as I recall, was sued for the way that the public defender system operated. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember the outcome of that lawsuit.
It was dismissed. So basically the lawsuit said, you know, these flat fee contracts are making it so attorneys have no time to have meaningful conversations with their clients before they go make these decisions that will affect the rest of their lives. You know, they don't have time to consult in a meaningful way. The judge found, so the plaintiffs in that lawsuit were three people who were incarcerated at the time, but their cases hadn't been resolved yet. And the judge threw out the lawsuit because he found that the people who were the plaintiffs hadn't actually suffered real harm yet because their cases hadn't been resolved. So that's why it was thrown out. It wasn't on the merits of the public defender system, just that the plaintiffs hadn't actually suffered harm.
Okay. You know, you spent I guess a day with Ed Flint. What does that day look like? I mean, there's a lot you could go into, but he's a very busy person.
It was so busy. Yeah. I mean, we started at like 8 a.m, you know, showed up at his office. He's going through cases. I think he had like 22 that morning. Then we go over to the courthouse and he spends 4 hours representing these 22 clients, take a quick lunch break, and then we're just popping back and forth from district court over to justice court, back to his office. He's answering emails, and he's just going this whole time, you know, rushing in and out. And of course, it's like St. George, so it's like 105 degrees down there. And you really kind of feel following around, you know, jumping in and out of the car, going all these places, you feel like that heat and that. It's a tiring day. After, you know, he ended at 5, which he said is unusual. Usually, we came on a slow day. But normally he can have twice as many cases and he can be in the courtroom until, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock. So it's a big day.
I want to ask you how you found him in a minute. But mm-hmm. first I want to talk to Robert Gierke, a columnist on this and the system in place. I mean, the public defense system, we all have this right to an attorney. But, you know, there's a degree of how well any given attorney can treat you when they have 287 different cases at the same time. What are your comments on the way right. that this is playing out?
I mean, first, it was a great story Jessica did, and if you haven't read it, go check it out at sltrib.com, because it really brings home an issue that's been sort of festering in the state for quite a while, and makes it, I think, tangible. People understand it. You know, like you said, it's a constitutional right that you are entitled to representation. But that representation has to mean something for that right to mean something. And we have this vast discrepancy in the way that the counties manage this program. Salt Lake's program is pretty good, and Utah County's program is pretty good. And you know, the people I talked to pointed to Weber County being maybe not quite as good, but Davis County maybe, you know, but pretty solid. But then you've got these other counties that just they do it on the cheap, and there's no incentive for the county commission to appropriate money to defend, you know, pedophiles and drug dealers, you know, but these people are entitled to a defense. And so it needs to be done in a meaningful way.
Right. I mean, accused pedophiles and drug dealers, right? I mean,
right,
this is the whole point of the system.
Yeah,
of law.
No, yeah. Totally. And so you end up with these people like Ed who, you know, are busting their tails to make sure that these people get the representation that they deserve. But it's just not tenable the way that we've been doing it.
Jessica, how mm-hmm. did you track down Ed Flint? Where did you? I mean, obviously, you wanted to profile one public defender.
Right.
Why this one?
So I have known Ed for a couple of years, just covering criminal justice system, and you know, he tends to have a lot of high profile cases down there, and so I was always calling him for, you know, the homicides and all the cases that we tend to put in the news. And every time I would talk to him, he would make these asides about how busy he is and how much work he has to do and this huge caseload that he has. And he's very outspoken about how much work he has, and he's pretty critical of the system.
Ed's very outspoken about everything.
Yeah, he is. So, you know, Washington County is interesting because it's growing so quickly. And so for a county that size to still be doing flat fee contracts is just an interesting place to be in. And so, you know, it's kind of the perfect scenario of you've got a really outspoken public defender, because a lot of them aren't. A lot of ones that I've talked to don't want to talk about this because they're worried that if they are critical of the county who gave them that contract, they might lose their job.
I really encourage listeners to check out Jessica Miller's profile of Edward Flint, and you can find it at sltrib.com. However, at this exact moment, it's time for our final segment of the show, the Underplayed Stories of the Week. And Jessica, I will just continue on with you. What's your pick for Underplayed Story?
So I'm going to pick a story that was published this morning by Becky Jacobs, who is our women's issues reporter. And she wrote about how this last legislative session, we saw a big increase of bills targeting incarcerated women and why why that was happening. We've got more women lawmakers working now, and those were all sponsored by women. So she just explores this phenomenon that we've seen for years. There had been no bills that were in place to help incarcerated women, and kind of what's changing now.
Wow, representation matters. Mm-hmm. That's check that out at sltrip.com. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I've really been fascinated following Ben Wood's coverage of the soap opera unfolding in Utah County about their commission, an effort to sort of revamp the way that they to go from a 3-member commission to a 5-member council. And there's been this back and forth. One of the commissioners ended up trying to block it. He ended up getting rolled by the other two commissioners, so the idea right now is they're going to proceed with the expansion vote. But you know, there's just been this really interesting back and forth, and you can read more about it at sltrib.com.
Check it out. Ben Wood's coverage is really interesting. I'm going to go for my part with a story about a group with a name out of comic books, the Refugee Justice League, but that has a very serious message. They say that Utah could easily handle double the number of refugees now arriving in the state. And they this week issued a call for Utahns to push back against proposals that could lower quotas for refugees to zero. You can read that story by the Tribune's Lee Davidson and all of the stories we've been discussing, again, at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller and Robert Gerke, both with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
That wraps up this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to KCPW Operations Director Jesse Ellis for his help on the show. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend, and please join us again next Friday.